Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. What I want to do this morning is to present the kind of the old basic theory of reality therapy. And I know people were here last year and heard the basic theory, but in the course of a year I've changed around a little bit. So it won't be exactly the same as last year. Mostly because as time goes on, you think about various things, and during this past year I've been thinking about a whole new concept, which I'll discuss probably tomorrow, maybe tomorrow morning, concept which I call positive addiction, which is kind of an interesting idea, and it stemmed from the problem that confronted me, and I'm sure confronts you, when you're trying to deal with a person, whomever you're trying to help themselves. You can look at help in lots of different ways, and as I say, this past year I've been looking at it in terms of strength and weakness, psychological strength and psychological weakness, mental strength, whatever you want to call it. And because I've come to the conclusion, obviously it's not any outstanding conclusion, but nevertheless, it seems that you can talk about people whom you deal with in various ways. And originally I talked about them in terms of effective people and ineffective people. Just again, the two groups of people. Then I talked about people in terms of, in reality therapy, responsible people and irresponsible people. Then when I went on and worked in the schools and considered the concepts of the identity society, I talked about people as successful people or people who were failing people, people who had identified themselves as successful and lived up to that identity, people who looked at themselves as failures and acted and lived up to that particular unfortunate kind of an identity. All of these terms are perfectly valid. There's really not much difference between them. It's just that at particular times, this is how I looked at people. It seemed to make sense. Well, in this last year or so, I've been looking at people in terms of strength and weakness. Well, you could say a successful person is strong. You could say a responsible person is both successful and strong. You could say an effective person is all of those things. Certainly these terms used interchangeably. But for reasons which I'll talk about this morning and probably continue talking about throughout this two-day conference, I think at least right now I like to use the term strength, because the people that most of us deal with, they seem to be weak. They seem not to have the strength to do what they think they ought to do, or at least someone else thinks they ought to do. It's almost as if many people you deal with, I noticed a lot of hands were raised with drug problems and alcohol, which is, of course, a drug problem too. And many of the people you deal with, not all of them certainly, but many of them would say they would like to stop drinking, or they'd stop using drugs. And they realize it would be good for them, it would help them, and their families would be happier, and they could work more successfully. They have all the reasons. They really say they'd like to stop. And they try to stop. And what seems to be lacking and what seems to be frustrating in your working with them is that it doesn't seem they have the strength. They just don't seem to have the strength to stay away from these particular substances which give them pleasure and relieve their pain and things like that. And so when I've been working the last several years and with people and thinking about it myself, it seems to me that what I'm trying to do with the people that come to me, regardless of what their problem is, or the people I'm working with when I work in schools, is to help them to get enough strength really to do what they say would be good for them. It's one thing to say this is good, it's another thing to gather yourself together and have the strength to do it. And so, in terms of strength and weakness, then you have to say, and this is something that, again, we'll discuss in much more detail, perhaps tomorrow, but basically, if we just had another person sitting in that chair over there, if the chairs were together and I were talking to the person sitting in that chair, I might ask him just a question just flat out and say, you know, are you strong? Now, if we selected someone, say, at random from the audience, it's very possible we could get someone who could answer that question and very affirmatively say, yes, I am strong. And I'd say, well, what do you mean by strong? In other words, what do you think, what do you mean by it? You say, well, I can handle things. Things come along in my life, I take care of them. I don't fold up at the least stress and strain. I mean, something happens and I'm able to take care of it. I'm able to handle my life adequately. I'm able to find pleasure in life. I'm able to live what I call a fairly rich and enjoyable life. There's some zest for living. There's some real happiness in my whole situation. It takes strength to achieve that. So if a person would answer the question that way, well, certainly I would agree that that person would sound to me like they were strong. And so I'd say, okay, I agree, you're strong. Okay, I just wanted to check it out, but I agree. Now, what made you strong? How'd you get all this strength? Because there are a lot of people in the world that wouldn't be able to answer the question that way at all. So where did this person, this hypothetical person that we asked to sit up here and answer that question, well, where'd you get that strength? Well, I think a strong person would know where he got that strength. He would say, well, I was raised in a good home. I had a mother and father that cared for me. I had aunts and uncles and grandmothers and brothers and sisters. And, you know, we had our ups and downs, but mostly we cared for one another. And they taught me and they showed me and they cared for me. And they stuck with me when I was kind of struggling. Well, that's certainly one of the ways that you gain strength. You have people that care for you enough to stick with you and love you and show you and have confidence in you and faith and not to kind of fold up the moment hard times come, but they kind of hang in there. That's the purpose of a good, loving family and friends. So that's where you get strength. Certainly, anytime you feel that you're cared for, that you've got friends, family, husband, wife, lover, whatever you've got that's something important to you, it gives you the feeling of strength, the feeling of confidence, whatever that feeling is, it gives it to you. And many of the people that we're dealing with, if you check back into their history, you don't have to check back very far, you just have to perhaps ask them what's going on now, you'll find they don't have that. We're dealing with people who, for the most part, are not strong. We're dealing with people who, when you check into their story, well, they don't have this kind of a close relationship right now, and maybe haven't had it for a long period of time. So love and friendship, that partly gives you strength. The other part, I said, all right, well, what else? And the person would say, well, not only do I have people that care for me, but I do things in my life that I believe have some value. I achieve something. I live a worthwhile life, whatever you want to call it. And I'd say, well, what do you mean? And they'd say, well, you know, as I grew up, and this happens to all of us, as we grow up, people say, this is good, do it, this is worthwhile, this is the right thing. Now, the people that say these things aren't altogether right. They don't always have the right way for us. But nevertheless, as we grow up, and we're affected by the people around us, our family, our friends, our teachers, our neighbors, examples in the newspaper and other places where we perhaps can set an example from people we don't know, they affect us too if they're important type people. Well, we just begin to believe in certain things, that's all. And we believe that doing some things have value. Now, they may not have the same value for everybody, but each person as he grows up, he develops what he considers to be some worthwhile things that he tries to do and usually to some degree does with his life. And when you're doing these worthwhile things and you succeed at doing them and you set your own standards for success partly and partly other people set standards for your success, but you get the idea that you're making it, you're succeeding. And when you have this idea, that too builds strength into you. Those are the two general ways, I think, in which a person who said that he was strong, if he answered that question, I think that he would defend his his answer to that question with the things that I said. He's got love in his life. He's got some worth in his life. Again, if you examine the lives of the people that you deal with, in most cases, at least at this time, you're dealing with them now, so they must have difficulty now. And at this particular time, they don't have sufficient love in their life, so they feel very strong, and they usually haven't done anything that's very worthwhile according to what they believe is worthwhile, and certainly getting confirmation from others that what they're doing is worthwhile. They don't have too much of that. Now, what happened? What's the purpose of being strong? I mean, there has to be sense to it. Well, the purpose of being strong, it helps you to lead a good life. It helps you to find happiness. I mean, if we had a philosophical thing going here, I'm not terribly philosophical, but Harry's a minister, along with being a college teacher, and if Harry came up here and led a little discussion in a sense, and what's the purpose in life, which is a kind of a ethical type thing to some extent and everything else, a lot of people could answer what it is, and I'd say that everyone that answered would be right. I don't think there's anyone that if you asked them what the purpose in life and he gave you a reasonable answer, he could possibly be wrong. There's no set definition. At least I haven't run across any. There's many people could have slightly varying things, but most people, if you ask them the purpose in life and they ask you and they answered honestly, because there's a lot of baloney, you know, when you ask people about the purpose in life. There's a lot of stuff that isn't really true, but people say it, you know, because they want to be heard, and they think it's good and all this kind of stuff, and that's all right. I got nothing against that. I mean, but if you ask most people and they're in an honest frame of mind what the purpose of life is, I think they'd say, well, an important purpose in life is to be happy. And I just don't think you can fault that, that's all. If anyone says, well, that isn't at all the purpose of my life, this would be a very odd person. I'd say the country has lots of odd people, and it's a big country, you know, and there's room for everybody. But most people want to be happy. And most of us, if we were faced with a life where we knew we could find absolutely no happiness whatsoever, if we were in some kind of a terrible situation where all we could look forward to is things getting worse and misery and upset and everything else, most of us, if we were faced with that kind of a life, really wouldn't choose to live. If we could, if everybody's sitting around up there in heaven, you know, before you're born and the stork is coming and the stork says, look, we got place down there, but it's going to be miserable. Well, a lot of people sitting up there, little babies, would say, well, you know, pass on me. I don't want to take that place, you know. In other words, none of us would like to look forward to a life of misery. We'd rather not be born. Now, I don't want to get in any big philosophical questions. There are some people that believe it's worthwhile to exist, that every miserable life has a silver lining, and maybe it does, but I... personally, I wouldn't like that kind of a life anyway, you know. So if you have any choice ahead of time, which ordinarily you don't, but if you did, very few people would choose to be miserable, saying it'll make a better person out of me or anything like that, because I don't think it does. I think it makes a worse person out of you to be miserable. If there's such a thing as a better or worse person, that's another philosophical question I don't want to get into, but... The thing is that a lot of people in this world, when they're faced with enough misery, they elect to leave the world. They say, I'm going to kill myself, and they do. And there's usually, in a conference like this, or somebody raised a question about suicide. And what is the responsibility of a person in the helping type profession when they're confronted with suicide? And it's not easy to answer. But... ordinarily, the responsibility would be to try to persuade a person to keep living. We all, and what's the persuasion that we got going for it? Keep living because all this misery is going to make you a better person? That isn't going to cut too much ice. You got to persuade people by saying, you know, it's going to be better tomorrow. You know, that's the major argument that you got to put forward. That maybe things will perk up a little bit or something like that. But generally, people make up their minds it isn't worth it, and they kill themselves. I got the statistic the other day, and it's an inaccurate statistic, that 50,000 people in the United States kill themselves each year. Now, that isn't a lot of people in a country this size. 200 million people, 50,000 is quite a small number, but still, just to end your life, it's a substantial figure. And many people who are kind of experts in the field feel there's an awful lot more than that to do it that really are never really known as suicide, like a fellow that gets drunk and drives his car into a lamppost, really killing himself, but it's called a traffic accident or something like that. So a lot of people elect to do that. They do it because they look forward to nothing but misery, and that's why they do it. And there's a lot of people nowadays, and whether this is ethically right or not, you decide. I'm not taking a stand on it one way or another, because it'll never happen to me. But a lot of people decide that they're going to have an abortion. I mean, it's something I'll never have, but so that decision never going to be up to me. But women take that into their mind, that they don't want to have this baby for some reason or other. Now, what decision, why do they base that decision? They base it again on the fact that somebody's going to be miserable. Usually, in most cases, this child probably doesn't have much of a chance for life the way I can give him a life. Maybe I'm not set up well to raise a child now and things like that. Or maybe they base it on, I think this is much more rare, they base it on the idea that if I have this child, I'll be miserable. And usually, of course, these go together. But one way or another, right now in many states of the country, abortions and births running about neck and neck. So for every pregnancy, every two pregnancies, one ends up in a baby being born, and one ends up in terminating that pregnancy, mostly, again, based on this thing that someone's going to be miserable. So you can make a lot of arguments for other things, but I think happiness is very important to people. Very, very important. Or not happiness, certainly, and I think happiness is most important, than trying to get rid of the pain when you're unhappy. We spend an awful lot of time and effort trying to get rid of the pain. So if you ask the person that says he's strong, what's the good of being strong, the person will say, well, I'm happy, or I have a chance for happiness, or most of the time I feel pretty good. And that's probably correct, that strong people lead happier lives. They lead richer lives, more zestful lives, whatever you want to call it. There's all kinds of words for it, but they lead a better life, a fuller life. Well, what happens if you're weak? What if I plucked someone out of the audience and I asked them, well, you know, are you strong? And the person says, no, man, I'm weak. And what kind of person's around? There's lots of them around. Most of us do nothing but deal professionally with weak people, and there's plenty of them that we deal with non-professionally too. And so a lot of us have so many of them around non-professionally, we figure we may as well go into business. As long as we got them all around, we may as well learn it and do it professionally. So a weak person would say, well, why are you weak? He'd say the opposite of a strong person. Nothing mysterious here. I haven't got much in the lines of friendship, and I don't do much with my life that's worthwhile. I'd say, well, what happens to you? And a weak person will say, most of the time I'm miserable, because most of the time they are. I'm miserable and unhappy. And that's the way that a weak person is going to live his life, unless he can gain some strength. And so most of what we do is to try and help people who are miserable and unhappy be happier. But it's very difficult. Very difficult, at least the way I look at things in my experience, to get a person that's miserable to become happier. You know, how do you do it? How do you tell someone that's upset to be happy? It's very difficult. What you do if you're trying to help a person, it seems to me, and this is the purpose of reality therapy and the purpose of any other therapy, would be to help them gain some strength. Because if you gain some strength, then you can do more things with your life. And if you can do more things, some of the things you can do may help you to become happier, that's all. So this is what we're dealing with when we're dealing with a weak person. Mostly they come into us and they would say to us, I'm hurting. I don't feel good. Or I'd feel good if I could live my life in a certain way, but they won't let me, so now I hurt. It doesn't matter what the story is. The basic thing is you could be dealing with a drug addict, and the drug addict would say, if they give me my drug, I'd have no complaint. But the drug is a hassle, and I am always being hassled, so I hurt. And the point doesn't matter what the story is, that if you're weak, you tend to hurt. Now, what's the purpose of pain? Or for that matter, what's the purpose of happiness and pleasure? Now, this thing does get in a circular kind of a reasoning, and I don't know the absolute and super purpose of it. I'm not privy to the reason it's all there, but we're born and we're here, and we try to be happy. And when we're happy, we get feedback through this happy, good, pleasurable feeling. We get feedback that things are going okay. So what we've elected to do with our lives is in pretty good shape. That's the message that I get when I feel good. Don't rock the boat. Things are going well, keep it. That's the way it is. In other words, you have a tendency when you're feeling good to get conservative. You say, well, you know, better just keep things the way they are, that's all. And so you want to keep this good feeling going. So if you're doing certain things, keep doing them. If you're not doing certain things, avoid doing them. If you've got a feeling that you'll lose this happiness you have. The payoff for living a successful life is happiness. Or happiness is the payoff for living a successful life. You could look at it either way. It doesn't make any difference to me, but that's what people want. Now, how about this weaker person? What's he got? He's got misery, upset, pain. What kind of pain does he have? Well, there's an amazing variety of pain. If you get into the psychological business and you talk to people, they hurt in a wide variety of ways. Now, what's the difference how a person hurts? I mean, I don't ever consider that too important. The fellow tells me he hurts, I don't think it's much. He hurts because he's terribly tense and anxious, or hurts because he's depressed, or hurts because he feels a little crazy, or hurts because his belly hurts or his head hurts. What's the difference? He hurts. I don't think it makes much difference one way or another. But the purpose of this pain, there's an important purpose to the pain. The purpose to all pain is the same, in my opinion. All pain is trying to get this message to you as strongly as possible, and pain is a very strong way to get a message. The pain tries to get the message to you, change your way of living. However you've decided to live, or however people have decided you will live, depending upon where you are, well, the pain tells you that's not so good. Change it. The purpose of pain is to hammer that message home. Now, you can't always change the way you're living. But that doesn't cut any ice with the pain. I mean, then you got to kind of draw a compromise with your pain. You're hurting. I'd say that you get unfortunate, and like years ago happened to a lot of people, you get drafted in the Army. That's unfortunate. And when you're in the Army, at least in the beginning, it starts to hurt pretty bad. And so you get a big urge to change your way of living. But you look around and you decide that's not a good idea because that might hurt worse. So the pain tells you to change, but you can't change. You're in a situation which just can't be, you can't resign easily and things like that. And so what happens if you're weak? Well, if you're weak, you may decide to resign, change your way, get drunk, run away, go AWOL or something like that, and get into all the hassle that'll bring you. And then you'll mope and weep and you get locked up in the stockade and all kinds of things. It's terrible. If you're strong, you'll say, well, listen, this isn't going to last forever. I mean, it's just going to seem forever, but actually it's going to be forever. And so in a while it will get better. And it usually does. I mean, I've been in the Army and it was bad in the beginning, and in a while it got a little better. It was never great, but it certainly, once you stop rolling in the mud and stuff like that, it was one hell of a lot better. And so you just put up with it. So the difference between strong people and weak people, and there is a major and very concrete difference, is that if you have some strength, you're still going to run into trouble, misery, pain, stress, upset. People are going to reject you. You're going to not achieve all the things you want to. That's going to happen to you whether you're strong or weak. More so, of course, if you're weak. But when you're strong and things don't go right and you start to hurt and the message comes through, change your way of living, well, what you say to yourself is, maybe I can't change it right away. Maybe I got to put up with this hurt and misery for a while. Maybe I just got to stand it for a while, and eventually I can make things change. But a strong person is not driven by the pain, by the misery, by the upset, to do something irrational, something half-cocked, just to run off and do it. A strong person sometimes says, part of my strength has got to be to stand it right now. That's all there is to it. I can't do anything about it. I'm just going to have to hurt for a while, and gradually I'll be able to do something about it, or something will happen. He has confidence that eventually he'll be able to remedy it, but he doesn't run off immediately and start acting in all kinds of irresponsible, irrational ways. Most of the people that you deal with, many of them, certainly almost all the people in this drug and alcohol routine, and lots of other people similar to that, school problems, children who act up in school, they don't feel very strong. They hurt, and they do irrational things. And they just do very irrational, very things that are obviously not going to do them any good, but they don't have the strength to stand the pain. They're desperate to get rid of the pain. Because here you come again to this very important difference, that if you've got strength, you can say to yourself, I'll stand it for a while. And if you have strength, you not only say, I'll stand it for a while, you can stand it for a while. You're able to tolerate a certain amount of pain without doing something irrational. Now, a weak person is exactly the opposite. A weak person, when he feels the pain, and he says, how could I handle this? And he knows he doesn't have much love. That might help him to get rid of the pain if he had some love, but doesn't have it. He knows he doesn't have much chance to achieve very much because he hasn't done that for a long period of time, maybe very long period of time. So what he looks at is, I'm hurting because I'm weak and I don't have much love and much worth, but I'll never have much love and much worth. So I'm destined to hurt for a long period of time. That's a very, very frightening position to be in, to be in a very painful situation and have no idea how you can get out of it at all. But your past track record has been totally unsuccessful in terms of getting out of this misery. And so, unlike a strong person who looks at the pain and says, goodness, it's miserable, but I'll gradually take care of it, a weak person looks at the same pain and says, I gotta get rid of this pain. I just have to. He becomes driven, overwhelmed by the pain and driven by the pain to do something to reduce it. Because he says, I just can't live my life with all this hurt. Now, if we'd suggest to him, we'd say, well, don't. I mean, go out and make some friends, get some love, do some worthwhile things, buckle down, go to college, get a good job, reorganize your family, stop drinking, you know. But see, he doesn't have the strength to do those things. That's good advice. Goodness knows it's good advice. But if you don't have the strength, then the advice isn't worth that much. It just isn't worth it. The world is filled with people who give people good advice. But do they have the strength to take it? And advice isn't bad. It's good to give people advice, and sometimes people do take it, but take strength. So if you don't have the strength to follow what you know to do, or someone obviously tells you the correct thing to do, and you're faced with this hurt, this pain, then you decide, well, what in the world can I do? Now, everybody isn't exactly weak or strong. Some people most people are in between. We have a certain amount of strength, but we have areas in our life, portions of our life, parts of our life, where we can't handle things well. So we don't have pain all the time. Like we may have a fairly satisfactory home life, but a miserable job. And so we don't hurt that much at home, but when we go to work, we hurt. And then the hurt is to say, do something about your job, change your job, but maybe you need that job for a living, so you're just destined to hurt for a long period of time. That's the way it is, but you're strong enough to tolerate it and say, well, if I quit the job, things will be worse, then maybe my home life will be bad. I won't have enough money to support the family or something like that. So it isn't that people are totally strong or totally weak, although some are. And many of the people that you work with, interestingly enough, seem to be very close to totally weak. There doesn't seem to be much of a place where you can see that they have some strength. But most of us in this room are kind of in between. We're not totally strong. We have areas in our life where we get along great. And other areas that we haven't the strength to handle well, and we don't know what to do about it, but we at least have the strength to suffer. And so we suffer in those areas. But it isn't our whole life. And with that kind of a compromise, many of us live. If we could get more strength, it would be good, and I'll talk about that some tomorrow morning. But for the most part, we get along well enough so that the pain, if you've got some strength, doesn't dominate your life. But if you've got very little strength, the pain starts to dominate your life. And then what you do is you begin to make some decisions. And the decision you make, if you're hurt enough, has to do with, again, finding love and work. Because you're hurt, because you don't have enough love or enough work. That's why you're hurt. But you haven't had much success in finding it. You're hurting because you struggled and you haven't succeeded. And so now when you have this pain and you know from your own history, because you know your own history, that you struggled and you haven't succeeded, then you have a decision to make, and this is a decision that all of us make. Some of us make it with parts of our lives. Many people make it with all of their lives. The decision is, should I keep struggling or should I give up? That's a very, very important decision. If you're working in the public schools, you run into people, children, who made that decision, essentially, and that's your trouble. If you didn't have kids who'd made the decision to give up, you would have almost no trouble in public schools. But they give up. And when they give up, it causes an awful lot of trouble. They perhaps say, well, I can't make it in school. I give up on school, but I got to have some kind of recognition. I'm somebody. So they change their way of living from a good student to a bad student. They start making trouble. That gets them some recognition. And that causes schools problem. When I go around schools, they concern themselves with discipline a lot. All kinds of questions about discipline. Kids out of order. Well, the kids who are out of order are the children who've given up. They make up their minds to give up. I was in New York State not long ago talking to a reading conference in a room that was must have been four times the size of this room. Huge room. 3,000 people could sit in that room, and there was about 2,500 people sitting there. I couldn't believe it when I walked in and saw all those people. Now, what was this conference about? I said it was a reading conference. All these people, 2,500 of them, and that didn't represent, I'm sure, everyone in New York State that did this. All these people were there because they had elected to help teach little kids who couldn't read or couldn't read well to read better, to read or to read better. So think of that, 2,500 people. If every person there dealt with 30 or 40 kids, you're talking about, geez, I don't know, thousands and thousands of kids. So, a woman named Paula Nix, N-I-C-K-S, has an emergency call. Where would that be? In the back? Out in the lobby. Okay. So I say to myself, look at all these people. They're all sitting here, and they're all sitting here because kids, mostly little kids, but not all little kids, have given up on learning to read. That's why they don't read. They've given up. They've said, well, should I read or shouldn't I? Well, if I read, I don't think I can. I don't think I can. I'm way behind anyway. I just won't do it. Why hassle it? And so a lot of kids, they just give up on learning to read. That's all. And we get alarmed about that. We hire people. And, of course, you could say that these kids not learning to read, they make a lot of work. That's one thing they certainly do. But the 2,500 people that are just elected to teach kids who've given up on... Because reading is not that hard. If it were that hard, nobody could hardly read, but most people read, so it's possible. The point is that the children who have given up say, it isn't worth the hassle to me. The pain of trying is going to hurt worse than giving up, because the purpose of giving up, the purpose of any time you give up or I give up, and the purpose that the people we work with, the purpose they had in giving up was to reduce their pain, because giving up almost always, at least temporarily, doesn't do it for long, long periods, but it's at least the first step. It temporarily does reduce the pain. And so you're dealing with people, for the most part, who've made any one of three choices once they've decided that they haven't the strength to find adequate love and worth for themselves. And the first choice they make is the choice to give up. That, to them, makes more sense than to keep struggling and not make it. And it just hurts less to give up. Just give up. Classical story from Aesop's Fables. Remember the fox that was jumping for the grapes? Well, what did the fox do? When he couldn't reach the grapes, he said, well, he said, the grapes are sour. That's a perfectly reasonable statement. We've done that many times in our life. We don't like ice cream anyhow, or we didn't like that girl anyway, and various things. But the point is, the fox said this because it seemed to him that if he couldn't reach them, well, they must, it's easier to think of them as being sour than being good, so that's what he did. Now, Aesop, I've been in touch with him recently, and I heard the rest of the story. You see, I always felt that that wasn't the whole story there, and Aesop says, yeah, there was a lot more, but... He says his publisher was satisfied with that, so he let it go at that. But I said, well, I'm not satisfied. So he says, well, he says, actually, he said, there was a lot more to it. He said, after the fox said the grapes were sour, he said, that didn't really work that well, because the fox wasn't the fox without friends. He had a few friends. And among his friends were some foxes who were better jumpers. And they jumped up and they reached the grapes. And as good friends will, they occasionally, not all the time, but occasionally they threw him a bunch of grapes. And the grapes were delicious. Absolutely the best grapes he'd ever eaten. And so it made it difficult for the fox to keep saying they were sour when he actually had a chance to taste them and they were good. And all his friends said they were absolutely delicious. So now the fox had a... So then he went out and jumped some more. But he didn't reach them. And so the fox ultimately had to make up his mind. He says, you know, this jumping, he said, the ground under the grapes wasn't that smooth anyway. And he says, getting his feet sore, he's jumping up all the time. And so the fox finally said, at grape jumping, I'm a bust. And so he says, the grapes are good, but I'm a weak fox. And that's the end of the story. So he turned out not able to use that delightful rationalization. He just had to finally face the facts that as a grape jumper, he was no good. Well, that's how most of us end up, no matter how we rationalize. Rationalization is just a temporary thing. When we say, you know, that we can't get this or that, we live in a world, we watch TV, we see people getting it and enjoying it. It's easy to say it's no good or we don't want it, but it's not easy to believe that. And so most of us ultimately, no matter how much rationalization we use, we give up because we say that if we keep trying and we really sweat and we don't make it, and will not only not get the grapes, but will have sore feet too. So if you're not going to get the grapes, you may as well at least preserve your feet. And so the story was that the fox said, the grapes are good, but who needs sore feet? And that's how he ended the deal. Gave up. Well, in the giving up position, it does reduce the pain, because it's a hassle to keep trying for things that you can't reach. And so most of the people that you deal with, almost all the people you deal with, in the important areas of their life, and you deal with them in the important areas, they have chosen to give up, the first choice, because giving up does to some degree reduce the pain of failing. It reduces the pain of saying, well, why should I keep trying? I'm not going to make it anyway. There's a Greek mythological tale which kind of always intrigued me too. The story of Sisyphus. Now, Sisyphus was a giant, evidently, of some kind or other. I don't know exactly what a giant was, but he was a big man or something. And he was strong, and he aspired to be a god, which was a very, very a wrong thing for him to do, because the gods were very jealous of their prerogatives, and they got irritated at this giant that aspired to be a god. And they punished him to teach him a lesson and all other such aspirants a lesson forever after. They said to Sisyphus, for your aspiring to be a god, we're going to make you miserable. Teach you a lesson, teach everybody else a lesson too, and see what happened to you. They cursed him and said he would have to push a giant boulder up a mountain each day, just shove it up with all his strength. And there was a little niche at the top of the mountain where if he shoved the top, he could set it in that place, then his job would be over. But every day when he'd get it right up at the end of the day to the top of the mountain, just ready to push it into that place, a god who was doing nothing at the time would reach out with his finger and flick the boulder, and it would roll all the way down the mountain again. And poor old Sisyphus, he'd have to just start pushing up again. He was doomed to do that for eternity, which is a terrible thing to happen to anybody, and should teach him a lesson. I hope it did. But the point is, what would you and I do if you were Sisyphus or we were Sisyphus? I mean, what would we do if we had any sense at all? We'd give up. We'd say, we're not going to make it. You know, after you push it 2-3 times up the mountain and these gods flick it down again, we'd say, the hell with it. Who needs this? Some would say, well, you ought to do it. We'd say, well, no, at boulder pushing, we're a bust. And so, it's easier to give up than to keep going when you believe that the task is hopeless. Now, a lot of people here could say, but the task isn't hopeless. That's what people always say. But hell, that doesn't cut any ice. That doesn't cut any ice. Because if you think it's hopeless, that's your belief. One of the things I sometimes do, which I enjoy, is I watch football on television. And it's instructive. And sometimes what happens is a team gets into a game where they're a little bit outclassed. And they run into the fourth quarter, they're down 63-0. And it's raining. Now, the coach could give that team a little fourth quarter pep talk, you know, get them together for a moment or two and say, fellas, we can still pull it out. Keep going, fight on for old university, it's the honor and all that kind of stuff. Most of the ball players, however, would kind of be in what I call the give-up position. Because there never has been a team in the history of football that ever came back from 63-0 in the fourth quarter in the rain. It just doesn't happen. So what they're trying to do at that stage is survive. They're just trying to say, well, can we make it through this quarter with as little pain as possible? And when the opponent's fullback, who weighs 800 pounds and runs 90 miles an hour, comes thundering through the line, they're going to say, what the hell's the difference between 63-70? Go ahead, you know. They'll pat him on the ass as he goes by, you know. Because it doesn't make much difference at this stage of the game. Even if you've bet on the game, you're way past the point spread by that time. Nobody ever gives 63. I gave 50 to my kid on Ohio State this year, and they only won by 48. I was really heartbroken. I gave 50 points, and Woody Hayes blew it. He put in his fifth team in the end and let Northwestern score a touchdown. A hell of a thing to do. I hope he doesn't do it again. because Ohio State's easily worth 50 any time, but every once in a while it doesn't work out. So, how does Northwestern feel? Well, I think they ought to go to the college president, and they say, why do you schedule Ohio State, you know? And the president doesn't know why, so he wouldn't be around. The point is, it's hard not to give up. And so lots of times in life we can be exhorted by people who say, win one for the Gipper, but the Gipper ain't around, you know, and so people just don't do it. And the people you're dealing with, a lot of them, almost all of them have given up. They've given up because they can't see that hassling any longer is going to make their life that much better. Now, the problem with giving up is, it does have some serious problems. The problem with giving up is that eventually the pain comes back. I mean, life isn't like a football game. When the final quarter's over, the game's over, you can forget about it, you know. But most of the problems that people get into don't end as abruptly and as succinctly as a football game. They just kind of we're more like in situations like Sisyphus, shoving the old boulder, the fox jumping up for the grapes, not reaching them. And eventually you have to settle for less than you'd like to have in life. Now, settling for less than you'd like to have hurts. It may not hurt as much. It may not hurt as much as trying to get it and failing to get it. But it still hurts. In other words, if you take a course in college and you run into a tough situation and you drop the course because you don't want to get a low grade, well, that doesn't hurt as much as failing the course and having this low grade inscribed in the rocks on your record forever and ever, as colleges have a tendency to do. But giving up and dropping the course, if you need the course for some degree, like, you know, some kind of a course that you kind of needed, it was a requirement, well, that doesn't feel that good either, you know, but it's better. But ultimately, you have to face the fact that if you want to get this degree, you're going to have to take the course. Giving up only temporarily reduces the pain. And if all the other grape foxes were eating delicious grapes, saying, you know, I'm not good at jumping grapes, the fox would have to do more than give up, you know. He'd have to kind of get himself out of there, do something. And so what happens is that giving up is not the world's best solution because the pain begins to return. You still need the things that get you happiness in this world. And so what do you do? Well, what did the fox do? Aesop actually, he had a little more to the story that I never figured when he'd go and tell me a little more. He said, well, what happened? I said, what happened to the fox when he gave up? Aesop said, well, he said he went and he consulted a psychiatrist. Because he figured if all the other foxes could reach the grapes and he couldn't, he must have a serious personal inadequacy. And so he went to a psychiatrist, and now what's he going to tell the psychiatrist now? Ordinarily, when you go to anybody for help, whether he's a fox psychiatrist or a regular type, you just want to tell the person something that'll get their attention, that'll really make them feel as if, you know, man, this guy needs help. And so the fox was kind of reluctant to tell someone, as many people are, reluctant to tell someone that he'd given up on jumping for the grapes, because what happens whenever you tell a person you've given up, human beings have a terrible tendency to do this. They say, well, you shouldn't give up. I mean, keep going, you know, go out and get in training, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Even psychiatrists like myself have that tendency. And so when you consult a psychiatrist, you got to have a certain subtlety in this thing. You got to use your head a little bit. There was nothing wrong with the fox's brain. It was his legs that were weak. And so the fox said to the psychiatrist when he came there, he didn't say anything about jumping for grapes or anything. That story came out a lot later. What he said was, he says, doctor, he said, I'm depressed. Now, that's the reason to see a psychiatrist. I'm depressed. And he gets your attention, and he was depressed. It wasn't a lie. He was depressed. I mean, it is depressing to see all the other foxes getting those grapes, eating them, making wine, and having parties, and he had nothing going at all. It was a hell of a depressing thing. And so not only did he say he was depressed, by God, he was depressed. And the more he thought about it, the more depressed he was, which is one of the good parts about depression. It kind of grows as it starts, you know. Now, what's the psychiatrist going to say to him? I mean, suppose the fox was sitting there and consulting me, and I'm trying to help him out. I mean, he's plunked down his money. He's as good a patient as anybody else. That's the one thing that you got to always know, that when you're in this business, one person sees you just as good as another. I mean, you can't, don't have favorites or anything like that. Everybody's equal. And so his problem's good as anybody else's. Don't ever have anyone tell you that's a good patient or a bad patient or anything like that. His trouble's as good as anybody else's. And so he comes and sits down there and he says, I'm depressed. Now, from the psychiatrist's standpoint, I mean, the fox didn't say I was depressed just to make a statement of fact and leave it go at that. He said it was depressed. It was kind of a question he was saying. He was saying, I'm depressed, and doctor, I need help. I'd like to get over this pain, this misery, this upset. Now, help me. That's what a person says to you when they say they're depressed. When they ask of professional help, they want help. They want to get over this pain, and they're looking for help. So what could you tell them? I mean, you got to say something. You could hedge the question a little bit by saying, well, how long you've been depressed, but, you know, he'll tell you, and then you're still back to the point where you got to help him. That question doesn't last too long. And there's Richard Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L, come to the phone, too. So this is not an emergency, just come to the phone. And, so the other thing you can say to him is, well, tell me about your depression. Now that only begs the question for a little while too, because he'll tell you about it. He'll tell you, well, I've been depressed for a long time. I've been feeling badly for a long time. It's just been terrible. But you see, he says, all right, doctor, I've told you how long I've been depressed, and I've told you how badly I feel. Now, please, I need some help. So now you're really faced with that. You got to do something. See, you're all your hedging's gone. You could say, "Tell me about your life and your history," and that might be. But eventually, he's going to tell you all that too. And he says, "Well, now I want some help." So what you got to say is something. And so what I say to the fox, if he tells me this story, and he says, "Are you really depressed?" "Oh yeah, I'm depressed." I said, "Well, I tell you what. Why don't you cheer up? Why don't you do that?" That's good advice for a depressed person. But the fox, he'd say, well, man, he said, if I could cheer up, I would. He'd say, but I can't cheer up. I'm depressed, man. I'm hurting. I'm upset. I feel terrible. What kind of advice is cheer up? Hell, my friends have been telling me that. I say, well, your friends give you good advice. You should have taken it, you know. But you see, that doesn't work too well. It's good advice, but he's not about to cheer up. He doesn't have the strength to cheer up. It doesn't seem possible to him. He'll even say, I can't cheer up. But see, that's not right. He can. If he can gain some more strength, he'll be able to cheer up. But he doesn't think he can. And so then you got to come up with something else. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit, but the point is that what the fox has done is he's chosen to be depressed. Now, what good does depression do? Well, it's the second choice. It's among the second choices. The first choice is to give up. The second choice, the main second choice, is to choose a symptom of some kind or other. The fox happens to have chosen the symptom of depression, a very common choice. Isn't the person in this room hasn't chosen on many, many occasions. It's always there, ready to be used. Now, why do you choose to be depressed? Well, you're always depressed when you can't find sufficient love and worth. Say someone rejects you, or someone doesn't give you what you want, or someone smashes up your car, you get sick when you're supposed to have an important date someplace. All these things are depressing. You get depressed. Now, why do you get this feeling of depression? Why'd the fox get it? He got it because he couldn't reach those grapes, you know. It was terribly depressing. Well, depression does two things for you. both of which tend to reduce your pain again. You choose these things because they reduce your pain. Painful as a symptom is, it's less painful than if you live with the knowledge you're inadequate and you won't make it. So giving up only works for a while, and then the inadequacy starts to pile up on you. So then you choose a symptom. The fox chose depression. Now, what good does depression do? What two things does it do for him? Very simple. Number one, it allows him to ask for help. If you're depressed, you can just ask for help, that's all. It's a very easy way to go to a person and say, help me. To go to a person and say, I'm a bad jumper, they'll say, well, practice, jump harder. You know, don't bother me, it's your fault, you know, you're inadequate. But if you say, I'm depressed, well, it doesn't seem as if you're quite so inadequate. Now, you develop in other people, when you're very depressed, a certain compassion arises. So certainly it serves that purpose. It allows you reasonably to ask for help. The second, that reduces your pain just by getting you close to another person. It allows you contact through your depression to other people. Maybe they'll care for me. I'm so sick, I'm so upset. The second thing depression does, it allows you in your own mind to rationalize your inadequacy. You see, if you go to a person saying, I can't get work, and the person says, well, have you looked? They say, no, I've given up. The person says, well, don't give up, get going, look. But if you go to a person and say, I'm terribly depressed, and the person will say, what are you depressed about? Well, I can't find work. Well, then the person won't expect you in this depressed state to go out and look. You're too depressed. It rationalizes your inadequacy. The choice, the symptom, then helps you to feel less pain because I am sick and inadequate and need help. That hurts, but doesn't hurt as much as saying, you know, I'm just inadequate. It builds a rationalization. It's perhaps a more subtle form of sour grapes, a much more effective and more subtle form of sour grapes, which is very ineffective because the grapes were sweet. Well, there are four major symptom categories that comprise this second choice. And these categories, these symptom categories, are the common one that little kids learn when they're tiny little children. The first symptom category is giving up. And then when you give up saying, well, I can't find love and worth, and then moving into the symptom category, which is getting angry and saying, why am I deprived of my chance for love and worth anyway? Why can't I get these grapes like everybody else? So the fox, he could get angry instead of depressed. He didn't happen to choose that, Aesop said, but he could have chosen it. Now, what could have he done if he got angry and said, I'm going to get those grapes regardless of others? Act out. Well, he went out, pawn shop, pawned his last few things, and he got himself a gun. Now, with a gun, he said, I can get me some grapes. He went around where there was grapes and foxes, and he had 60 foxes jumping for him just because he had a gun. A gun has an amazing way of getting people to jump. Now, but pretty soon he loaded himself up with grapes and wine and everything else. He fell asleep. They took the gun away and they locked him up in jail. Well, that happens to people that use guns occasionally. Not enough, but occasionally. And then in jail, well, he couldn't act out anymore, so he got terribly depressed. And that's where he called for the jail psychiatrist. But initially, he chose to act out. Now, a lot of people do that. Little kids choose it. They get a temper tantrum. What's a temper tantrum? A temper tantrum is, I haven't got the strength to find what I want in this world, but by God, I want it. And I'm going to scream and yell and rave and tantrum until someone gives it to me. Now, if parents are overwhelmed by their child's temper tantrum, they'll teach the child that temper tantrums pay off. And he may learn the rest of his life to be an acting out type person, saying, I can't get love and worth in the responsible ways that they're allowed to get them in the world, so I'll get them any way I can, regardless of others. I'll step on anybody. I'll rob, I'll steal, I'll yell, I'll con, I'll cheat, whatever it is, I'll hit and I'll get what I want. Usually, not always, but usually if a person does this excessively, someone says stop and eventually does stop him. But there are many people in this world who choose the first symptom category, which, when it's working, it really does reduce the pain. When it's acting out first, when that fox had those gun and those other foxes, they were all jumping and they were giving him bushels of grapes, he was flying. I mean, this was the supreme moment of his life. And he may say, hell, it was worth it. You know, the judge will sentence him, you know, to 20 years and all the fox jails. And maybe he has to peel grapes for the other foxes for 10 of those years and things like that. But he'd still say, man, it was worth it. And a lot of people who act out still say it was worth it. But the point is, acting out means I'm going to get what I want regardless of others. And many of you deal with people who act out. Our prisons are filled with people who'd rather do this than anything else. You let them out, they act out again, they go back to prison. And so this is their choice. They don't believe they can ever find love and worth anyway. They've given up, but the pain returns. They decide to act out. Now, the next symptom category is, I'll go through these briefly and then we'll break. The next symptom category is the one that the fox chose when he saw me initially. The choice to become involved with your own emotions, to say, I'm so upset, I'm so depressed, I'm so tense, I'm so anxious, I'm so fearful, I'm so dejected. Now, that does reduce the pain because it allows you to rationalize your inadequacy, it allows you to ask for help. A fellow that's robbing people, he can't ask for help too well, but he doesn't feel any more pain, that's working. But a lot of people, their parents don't encourage them to act out. They just learn that they're going to get stepped on if they do. So as they grew up, they learn to become upset, to become involved with their own emotions in order to ask for help, in order to rationalize their inadequacy. And miserable as it is, it does reduce the pain. It certainly does seem to work that way. Just take a depressed person, for instance. And let's say you've got a friend that's a little bit depressed. You say to your friend, you're trying to cheer him up. You say to your friend, come on, let's go. Let's go out. Let's go to a show tonight. Let's have a good time. Come on, let's get going. And the friend says, oh, no, geez, oh, I can't, you know, just leave, oh, you just, I mean, I'll be such a drag, you know. And when the friend says that to you, say, you know, you're right. It would really be a drag to take you to the show tonight. I think I'll go with somebody else. Well, you'll see an amazing lifting of the depression, just temporarily there, because it's not working well at all, you know, and the person, oh, well, wait, maybe I can get myself together, you know, and things like that. But if you beg them, you know, and you say, oh, please come, and I'll be miserable if you don't, and I need you tonight, and all this kind of stuff, why, they'll fly. That depression will be the happiest depression they've had in years, you know. So there's a pleasurable component of these things when they're working, when you can use them especially to manipulate people and get attention and this kind of a thing. A third symptom category choice is to say, I can't live in this world, because I can't find what I need here, so I'll live in the world of my own head. I'll go all the way into my own head. Most people go only partially into their own head. We call this psychosis or craziness. They live in their own head. It hurts to leave the world, so to some extent they suffer, but the point is that when they live in their own world, it does reduce the pain of the things they can't get in this world. The last choice, and most common of the four symptom choices or symptom categories, is to get sick. Millions of sicknesses. You know, there's every kind of sickness under the sun. And the sicknesses are all as a way to kind of say, I can't make it. Headache, very common. When I worked in Watts for 4 years, I had a headache every day when I worked down there. The headache was trying to tell me, leave, quit, don't go here anymore, it's too hard. But a part of me was saying, no, go there, you know. So I settled for the headache. But I had it. I couldn't get rid of it. Now, would there be any sense going to a doctor for this headache, or taking medicine or anything? That wouldn't have done much good. The point is that if I choose to go someplace which hurts, then I got to suffer the pain, that's all. But there's a part of me that didn't want to be there. And that part of me caused my head to hurt. Part of me that said, give up. And when I didn't give up, the part of me caused my head to hurt. Now, how did that reduce my pain? Well, I would have hurt worse if I'd given up. I'd made up my mind I was going to work there. So I had to settle for some pain. I could get a little sympathy with the pain. I could say, you know, I get terrible headaches, come home and say to my wife, you know, treat me gently, I have such bad headaches, and all that kind of stuff. But she kept saying, don't go down there if it hurts. So that didn't work too well. The point is that there's all kinds of psychosomatic illnesses. We choose all kinds of them. Headache, neck ache, back ache's very common, belly ache, colitis, iliitis, arthritis, high blood pressure, heart attack. Those kinds of things happen to people. They happen not totally for psychological reasons always, but a great deal. Now, what if you go to a doctor and you say, doctor, I've got these terrible headaches. What's he supposed to do? He examines. He should examine you carefully, give you a good physical examination, tests and everything else, and finally he'll say to you, say, I got good news. He'll say, what do you got? What do you mean good news? Well, he says, I got good news. There's nothing wrong with you. I've checked everything over. Well, to a fellow with headaches, that's not such good news. He'll say, what do you mean there's nothing wrong with me? I told you my head hurts. How come it hurts if there's nothing wrong? Well, that's a very, very serious question. And a question which, really, the medical profession legitimately has a terribly difficult time answering. And maybe that's a good time to have some coffee. Everybody's head should be hurting by now. So we'll kind of finish up some of the didactic lecture kind of thing to give you a background in this whole operation. And the way I've explained it this morning, I think, is kind of, to me, a fairly clear way to understand the problems that you're dealing with. We haven't finished yet. We have to go on to a little more explanation. But I think that this covers the people that you're working with pretty well. Then, of course, the question arises, what should we do to help this situation? How do you help people not to make these choices, or if they make the choices, obviously to then make better choices? And that's the purpose of therapy, and I'll go into that, try to get through at least some of those steps before lunch. And after lunch, I think that what we'll do is two things. I'd like to answer questions, and I'll answer any question that you submit, and you can submit your questions in writing. That's a really good way to do it. Just kind of leave them up here on the stage. Just set them down there if you want to. And I'll also, of course, entertain questions from the audience, or it's just that some people would rather put them in writing. That's all, and either way is okay. Now, as Harry said, and I want to emphasize this, a lot of questions will be questions like this. Well, Dr. Glasser, how would you deal with, or how would you handle a person who had this or that, you know, some problem, some condition, some complaint? The kinds of people that obviously that you work with and you're concerned with. How would you handle a child that continually acts up in school? How would you handle a person that in a drug rehab clinic? How would you handle a person that's terribly depressed? How would you someone just asked me a question. I said, somebody, I deal with people in a hospital setting who are terminally ill, and I deal with them and their family. How would you handle that? Now, there are general answers that I can give, but I prefer to give my general answers this morning in terms of this lecture, and then when I am asked a question about a specific person, how you deal with them, give more specific answers. And the most specific answer I can give you is to show you. It really is true that a demonstration is worth more than an explanation. We learn more from example than we do from lecture. Not that lectures are unimportant, but examples kind of make the lecture kind of come to life, I think. So if you are willing to portray a person that you're concerned with, or that you know someone else is concerned with, it doesn't make any difference who does it, then we could role play, just sit in that other nice chair and each take a microphone and you present a little bit of background, and then I'll be Dr. Glasser seeing this patient, and you can tell me, I'd like to see how you'd handle him on his first visit, Or you could say, I've been working with him a year, and this is about where we are, and now you take over. Say, this is about, you maybe seen him 35, 40 times. Or wherever it is, I'll intervene where you tell me to. And I'll play the person that you tell me that you would be. Whatever that particular person is. I can't do this perfectly, but I can show you more, and you can see more in how I'm struggling, because some of these people are very difficult. But I can at least show you how you would use reality therapy with them. I can't guarantee it would work or would work instantly or anything like that, but it is more effective. It also happens to be a heck of a lot of fun. It's a way to learn and have a lot of fun in the process. I mean, because part of reality therapy is to use humor as a method of getting involved with people, and I try to demonstrate this. So if you were willing to play someone, then see Harry, or I forget this other lady's name that's taking a name, and give them the information about whom you would play. And then we'll try to work some of these out this afternoon. It's very instructive and very enjoyable, that plus questions. And you can learn. You just can learn a lot from it. And I learn doing it. I mean, it's a very learning, much of a learning process. So we'll do that this afternoon. Now, I was explaining this morning about strength and weakness, and that weak people tend, under certain circumstances, lacking strength, they tend to give up. And when they give up, they tend to begin to hurt again. They give up to reduce the pain, because giving up does temporarily reduce the pain. Anytime you give anything up, it feels good for a little bit. But then you finally you got to get going again if you want what you want, and sometimes you just can't give up. You have to see that it's a temporary thing. But then to reduce the pain, when the pain comes back, you choose a symptom. And we went through acting out symptoms, went through emotional type symptoms like depression and anxiety, went through psychotic symptoms like choosing to live within your own head. If you're lonely, you can hallucinate up friends. If you feel inadequate, you can have a delusion of being more adequate. These are all the choices of the psychotic. And they're just choices that people make to get rid of their pain. One choice is about the same as another as far as I'm concerned. And I can demonstrate how you deal with all these if we have people here willing to play those kind of people. And then the choice to become physically sick is where we were. Psychosomatic illness is the most common illness that exists in the country. Vastly outnumbers the amount of people who are really sick. That means they got something that came from them from the outside. Psychological illness comes from within. It comes from your inability to find what you want in the world. And sickness helps you to rationalize your position better, or helps you out of a tough situation, or helps you to get attention. It helps you to do something. It's like, you know, nobody gets sick on a vacation. If you get sick on a vacation, you're really sick. That's not psychosomatic. Either that or you're terribly disappointed in the vacation. But if it's a good vacation, you just don't get sick, that's all. Now, a lot of people get sick around Christmas time because they're forced to associate with people they don't care for too much. And this sometimes upsets them. But, I mean, just because they're members of your family doesn't mean you like them. I mean, that you should like them, but it doesn't really mean you do. And this is a kind of a conflict that people have. I should like these people, but, God, they drive me crazy. Robert M. Stamps, S-T-A-M-P-S, has a phone call, emergency phone call. So, sickness is a very common and popular choice that people have taken from many, many, many years. And like they say, like, you know, there are all kinds. Where do you learn to be psychosomatically ill? Well, you learn it from the people around you. Like they say, migraine headaches run in a family. And then people think, well, if they run in a family,
They must be organically caused. Well, probably to some extent they are. Probably some families seem to have the tendency toward migraine headaches, and other families have the tendency toward ulcers. I'm sure this does occur, but also they teach them to each other. If you never see anybody with a bellyache, you might not learn to have one, but you can see them around. And so you say, you know, my mother had migraine headaches, and I have them, and my grandmother has them. Well, grandmother taught them to mother, and mother taught them to daughter. You'll learn. These are things that you do. So, regardless of what it is, now some of these psychosomatic illnesses are dangerous. They could kill you. Like a stomach ulcer, it can actually break through and cause bleeding. And the bleeding, you can bleed to death if you don't get treatment. So whether or not an illness is caused from within by personal inadequacy and giving up and the feeling of being weak, or whether it's caused from without, like chickenpox or syphilis or tuberculosis or a broken leg or something like that, either way, you need good medical care. But the medical care of a psychosomatic illness is not the same in the end as the medical care for a disease that is like a pneumonia, where you can treat it with penicillin or strep throat or something like that, or gallbladder trouble where the gallbladder is removed, or appendicitis. These are very definitely medical problems. Psychosomatic illness can be a medical problem also, but the doctor, if you've got an acute appendicitis, when the doctor takes it out, doesn't make much difference whether you're weak or strong, happy or unhappy, that's over. But if you've got, say, a bleeding ulcer, the doctor can take out your stomach and you still have problems, because if you haven't solved these problems, you'll get other problems, depression or ulcers where the ulcer was taken out. It's just common. So the doctor has to say to you, well, look, you know, there may be nothing wrong with you physically, or we've corrected the physical problem, but you still have things you ought to work on. It's incumbent upon a good doctor to explain to the people seeing him that they ought to get some help. They ought to work on some inadequacy in their life. Because if they don't, they'll continue to be sick. And that's a bullet that the medical profession hasn't bitten too hard yet. It's kind of a tricky thing, because people get angry when a doctor tells them. And doctors doesn't like to have a patient get angry. I don't say, doctor, are you telling me this headache is only in my head? And people have said that, you know. Well, I says, well, and you know, that's where it mostly is. Yeah, I can't figure any other place for it, you know. And, well, I mean, doctor, are you saying this is psychological? You know, and the intimation is, in my family, we don't have psychological problems, you know, or something like that. Or sometimes a parent will say that for a child. My child is strong, you know. He's strong, but he's got a few problems, you know. And so the point is that people don't like to be confronted with their inadequacy, and they look upon psychological problems as inadequacy. And to some extent, they're right. They are inadequacy. But they're inadequacy that can possibly be helped and would be worthwhile helping, because otherwise they're going to have the problem. And there's a continual and huge search for things to cure craziness. Vitamins is one thing. They use a lot of vitamins. You give a man that's crazy a lot of vitamins, because his lack of vitamins has made him nuts. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. But there is no strong indication that large doses of vitamins are going to empty out the mental hospitals and things like that. There's just no strong indication that's going to work. Now, the problem is, when you're dealing with any kind of a psychological problem, anything you do works, you know, for a while. Because a person who wants help is anxious to get help, and he's anxious to cooperate and show he's a good person, appreciates your dealing with him. And so if you give him vitamins, it's going to make him feel better. And if you don't give him vitamins and you do something else, it's going to make him feel better too. As long as you're doing something. Like they first thought when they got Thorazine, that drug was going to cure the mentally ill. Because when they start giving these people on the ward Thorazine, they start to feel better. Well, hell, they've been lying there for 15 years. No one did anything for them. Now they got a bunch of nice nurses came around, and doctors were seeing them again, say, we got something to help you, and here it is. Well, hell, these people take cyanide if you tell them it would help them. And it probably would help them. If it wouldn't kill them, it probably would help them. Because you're getting some attention and some care, and there's some hope raised, and people feel good, and they start saying, well, now you feel better. We'll get some more therapy programs going. Well, sure, these things all help. Does the drug help? Well, maybe it does to some extent, but not nearly as much as what surrounds the whole picture. So psychosomatic illness is important, and if you have it, you know, people get incensed. They come to after these talks and they say, well, I've had migraine headaches and that's not psychosomatic. Well, if it isn't, it isn't. I can argue with you. I don't know, you know. Most cases it is. In your case it isn't. I'm not going to fight with you, you know. But if you have migraine headaches for a long period of time, it would be worthwhile looking into what you could do to improve something in your life that's not going on as well as you'd like it, to do something about it. It's worthwhile taking a crack at it because these headaches are painful. And if you can do something to get rid of them, it would be worthwhile. And to get incensed when someone says that you can do something, because, you know, I mean, people would be almost happier as if they'd find out they had a brain tumor. Then it's not my fault. But personally, I'd rather have psychosomatic headaches than a brain tumor any day. Because in my experience, people with brain tumors don't do too well. And so, you know, that's just one of those things, you know. So if you have migraine headaches and you get angry at me for telling you they're psychosomatic, well, that's your privilege. And, you know, you could be the rare person that you may be lucky enough to have a brain tumor. Maybe they aren't psychosomatic. I don't know. But if someone with migraine headaches comes to see me and they're interested in getting some psychiatric help, I can usually help them to get over their migraine headaches. And so I'm inclined to believe if I can help them and I don't do anything except talk with them, that this talking helps them to make some better decisions about their life and they can give up having the headaches. That's just what I've run into, and I know a lot of other people who've run into the same thing that practice psychotherapy. So it's led us to the belief that this is a psychological problem. Anyway, you can make up your own mind and you can get angry at me if you want. I mean, just don't act out, that's all. Just get angry at me. You know, don't throw anything or anything like that, because if you really push me to the wall, I'll always agree with you that it's organic. Hell, I'm not going to argue with you. It's not my headache. Now, those are the symptoms. That encompasses all the people you deal with. But some people make a third choice. But they don't make the third choice until they've made the second choice. The first choice is to give up when you're weak and you can't find love and worth. The second choice is to choose one of these four symptom categories. And there's a tremendous variation of behavior under these various symptom categories. So that encompasses everybody that I can think of, covers these four groups: the actor outers, the emotionally upsetters, the crazy people, and the sick people. I can't think of any other group. Now, I mean, I should say this. There's no rules in this game. By that I mean, you can have two symptoms or three symptoms or all four symptoms at the same time. Usually people don't, interestingly enough. But they can. A person can be act out, he can be depressed, he can be a little crazy, and he can have a stomach ulcer. He can have all four. There's no rule that says you can't. But I can't think of any other symptom category besides these four. Now, there is another category, and many people here deal with this, but it's not in the symptom category. It's the next choice. The choice is that even though you have a symptom, and even though the symptom does to some extent reduce your pain, that is, it hurts less to have the symptom than it does to give up. In other words, the symptom choice hurts less. The pain is different than it's less, but it still hurts. It hurts to be depressed. It hurts to act out and have people shun you. It hurts to be psychotic and leave the real world where you have to fulfill your needs to leave it. It's a very painful choice. People get very upset when they're crazy. And, of course, it hurts in many cases to have a psychosomatic illness, very painful, disabling condition, depending upon what it could be. So with this pain and misery and discomfort, people have had this long before psychiatrists, people had this misery, and they figured out ways to get rid of it. And they're still using these ways, except in modern times, we have developed a whole industry to deal with the people who use these ways. Now, whether this industry is correct or not, that is, whether we should bother that much, well, I don't know. I sometimes think it'd be better if we didn't. But that isn't my decision, because we have made it an official policy of our government, state, federal, and federal, state, and local government, to deal with people who make the third choice. And the third choice is the choice to get rid of their pain through becoming addicted to something. And we have set up certain addictions as being illegal. And we set up certain addictions as being legal. So if you have an illegal addiction, the police and the criminal justice system becomes concerned with you, and to some extent also a rehabilitation system. Because the people that set these addictions up as being illegal, they get uncomfortable with it. And so they decide, well, we ought to help these people. And so you get a whole helping setup that kind of goes along with it. Then we have the legal addictions, like alcohol. That's legal if you're of age, and if you buy liquor that's got a tax stamp on it, it's legal. But the thing is that we set up a whole helping setup because we feel that these people who are addicted need our help. But we don't ordinarily treat them punitively and harshly too much unless they really mess up badly. And then we have legal addictions, which we don't really concern ourselves with governmentally that much. The illegal addictions are heroin and those kind of drugs. You know. Legal addictions are alcohol. Nicotine's a legal addiction, very addicting drug, but we don't have much to help nicotine people because nicotine is not an addiction like some of the others I'll talk about in a second. Then there are people, though, that eat too much food. They're addicted to food. There's no official policy governing those people. They get too fat, and they lead to themselves perhaps less than satisfactory lives, and they may even impinge upon their lifespan by eating too much. But governmentally, we don't have much set up for those people. They kind of look around for other things, and they're great book buyers. I'd like to write a book on reducing, because the fat people are great book buyers. Being fat and the ability to read evidently go together, very highly correlation. Well, I've never been able to come up with much, but I'm going to think about it. Maybe the high calorie, low exercise diet, I think that would go big, you know. That would. Anyway, the other addiction is an addiction which governmentally we should do something about, I suppose, because it causes problems, and it's gambling. Gambling is an addiction. Gamblers are really addicts. They go at their gambling with a vengeance. I haven't seen the two movies out, but there's two movies out on gambling now. Movies go in cycles, and they're in the gambling cycle now. And there's one movie's called The Gambler, I think. Another one is called California Split. But the guy that makes those movies doesn't use a soundtrack, so I don't see his movies. I mean, he doesn't. He just uses a microphone, and you can't hear what people say. The process of movie making has been advanced beyond what he's learned, and so I don't go to his movies. I'm not interested in all the background noise. I don't care about that. So anyway, but it's about gambling anyway, and people do gamble, and they gamble on everything. You know, they just gamble everything. I mean, a patient was a gambler once, and came to me and what's your problem? He said, I'm a gambler. And so he really was, you know. And so then we talked about it. And at the end of the first session, I says, well, how about the money? He says, I don't have any. And so I says, well, what do you mean? He says, well, he says, this was a gamble you took when you saw me and you lost. Well, that was true. And so I said, okay, fine, that's good. I said, would you like to see me again? Oh, yeah, he said. I says, well, then you'll have to come up with the money. You have to come up with the money for this hour and the money for the next hour in advance. Because I said, I'm not as much of a gambler as you are. I don't mind losing once in a while, but I don't want to lose on a regular basis. Well, he says, I don't have any money. I says, well, then you can't see me. And so I didn't see him for a while. He called about 4 months later. And he said, I'd like to come see you again. And I says, well, that's going to be, in those days, I think I was charging about $20 an hour. I says, that'll be $40, $20 for the last hour and $20 for this one on Barrelhead before I talk to you and listen to you. And so he said, okay. And so I got my $40 and I talked to him. And I saw him on and off. Oh, hell, I saw this guy over the years maybe 25 times over the last 10 years. And I always get my money in advance. Because when he calls up, I say, the only way that, I'm trying to help you give up gambling, I said, and I can't help you by setting a bad example, I said, so I can't be a gambler. That's the one thing. You never want to set a bad example. Well, I saw him last May, and he was looking like he was doing all right. I just saw him socially. He lives in my neighborhood, and he was a nice-looking girl and kind of walking around and dressed nice. They always dress nicely and seemed kind of calm, so his addiction was under good control. Anyway, these are the addictions. Now, what does an addiction do? An addiction does two things, and this is what you got to understand. An addiction has a very specific capacity which no one understands, but it has this capacity to reduce the pain of failure, of inadequacy. The failure and inadequacy of inability to find love and worth sufficiently for you. Therefore, if you have no love in this world, and you have no worth, and you hurt like hell, and you take an addicting drug, it's not absolutely sure, because people could differ, but there is a very large chance that you will become addicted to that drug. Because that drug will remove this pain that you feel. It'll go away. And when you got a lot of pain and you've been desperately trying to get rid of it, and now you get a hold of something like heroin or any of those drugs, like alcohol or any of the alcohol drugs, there's a whole bunch of alcohol drugs. The barbiturates are in the alcohol family. Some of the Librium Valium are in the alcohol family. These drugs will get rid of that pain. Maybe food's your thing, eat a lot. It'll get rid of the pain temporarily. If gambling's your thing, gamble. There may be other addictions, but those are the main ones. I call those negative addictions. Some people even smoke cigarettes to the point where you could call them a negative addiction, where they smoke 4 and 5 packs a day. Then they're into cigarettes in a very, very addicting way, and that's negative addiction too. Well, a negative addiction is something which does relieve your pain, but essentially reduces, almost eliminates any chance you'll ever have to find love and worth again with your life. In other words, you settle for the addiction and you give up really on the major chances of happiness. If one of the purposes of life is to be happy, then to be happy you have to find love and worth, and to find love and worth, well, you can't find it, so you become addicted and the addiction gets rid of the pain. Now, if you give up the addiction drug, the addicting drug, the pain comes back. Very specifically, that's how you know a drug is addicting. Because if you stop it, the pain returns. But an addicting drug or an addiction, they're not all drugs. Certainly gambling's not a drug, and food is not, in a sense, really a drug. But an addiction, and let's just use drugs because they're by far the more common thing. An addicting drug not only eliminates the pain, but it produces pleasure. It makes you feel good. Now, it's a very specific kind of pleasure. I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, but I want to introduce this idea now. the pleasure you get from an addicting drug is a passive pleasure in contrast to an active pleasure. The pleasure's all in your head. Now, all pleasure obviously is all in your head, but an active pleasure, like if I go out and find someone to love me and I hug them and kiss them and make love to them and that kind of stuff, that's an active pleasure. I'm out doing something which feels good. If I go to a football game and enjoy it, or if I go and get a better job, or I win a lottery or something like that, all these things, or go to a movie, any these are all, you're doing something, and those are active, the regular kinds of pleasures. And most of us, these are the kind of pleasures we have most of our life, this kind of pleasure. Now, it's also possible to have passive pleasures. And drugs produce a passive pleasure. In other words, the pleasure from the drug is inherent within the drug experience. A heroin addict, when he's on his heroin, he doesn't want anybody else. He doesn't want anything else. He really wants to be alone, to have his experience, whatever it is, perfectly satisfied to have it by himself. An alcoholic, very much the same way. He may drink with others, but basically he's drinking by himself. The others really aren't there when he gets into his drinking seriously. The same with a gambler. The others are there, but only to provide him with the game. The game becomes his whole life. The pleasure is within his head, the feeling. And those few people, not many people, are addicted to food. I mean, really addicted to it. I don't mean people that just enjoy eating. I mean people that eat inordinate quantities of food to get rid of the pain. They also get some kind of a buzz out of food, something a little more than any of us get. So these drugs do two things. Now, there are lots of drugs that provide us with pleasure, but if they don't get rid of the pain, then they're not addicting drugs. Some drugs are very close, you know, and so you could argue. But generally, the ones I mentioned are the only ones that are addicting. Like marijuana. It's a drug which will provide pleasure for people, but it's not addicting. By that I mean, if you have a serious, big old psychological hang-up of some kind, you're not about to smoke marijuana to get rid of it. Now, there are some people that will do this, but they'll smoke inordinate quantities of marijuana. These would be like people who are the nicotine super addicts that smoke inordinate quantities of nicotine. But the vast majority of people who use marijuana use it moderately. They have no real need to use it excessively. They use it for pleasure, and when they get the pleasure, they're satisfied. But if they have serious pain in their lives, they'll use something different from marijuana. The amphetamines, cocaine, are in that group. You'll use them for pleasure, for a different feeling and things like that. But if you've got a lot of pain, you wouldn't use those. You'd use something else. The cocaine is used in our society by fairly adequate people who are looking for some kind of a big, different experience. Like Freud, Sigmund Freud was a cocaine user. Sherlock Holmes was a cocaine user. These people were very adequate people, but they enjoyed the cocaine experience. When Holmes said, "Quick, Watson, the needle," it was cocaine. It wasn't heroin. Cocaine was widely used for pleasure. The Indians of Peru chew the coca leaves to give them some feeling of pleasure, which it does do for them and gets rid of some of the pain and misery of their lives. But it doesn't get rid of that specific psychological pain that's associated with inability to find love and worth. Or if it does it so much less so. It's less adequate than other drugs. So if these other drugs are available, like alcohol, which is legal and widely available, people will tend to use alcohol if they have a serious symptom-type problem. They're looking to get rid of the pain. And as I say, the drugs are addicting because when you get rid of the pain and you feel pleasure, my goodness, why give up the drug? Now, we can say to an addict, give up the drug, it's ruining your life. And by that we should mean, and I think we do mean, that it's ruining your life because under the influence of the drug, you will never look for love and worth. You'll just take the drug. Therefore, you can never find active pleasure in your life. You have to settle for these passive pleasures. But you also get rid of your pain. See, that's the thing that we kind of forget. It's not only the pleasure, you're getting rid of the pain. Well, the addict, he might say to himself, well, maybe I ought to give up my addiction. But as soon as he gives it up, then what happens? The pain starts. Now, when the pain starts, he has two choices, as everybody has. You know, the fox had the choice when he gave up. He had the choice when he depressed. But when you're addicted, the same choices are always there. The choice is, should I spend the time and effort to find love and worth, or should I settle for the drug which will get rid of the pain and give me this intense but passive pleasure? Well, all I can tell you is what happens. And what happens is most addicts continue to be addicted, because it's so tenuous to go out and look for love and worth. They've had no recent experience finding it anyway. Whereas the experience with the addiction is 100%. That's a sure thing. Absolute sure thing. They're always going to feel better. That was get rid of the pain. And they're always going to get some kind of a pleasurable added buzz on top of it. Now, this buzz may not be as great if they use the drug over and over and over again. They reach a limit, but it still will be there for a long, long period of time, long enough so they're not about to quit. And that's what makes an addicting drug addicting. Now, you say that also your cells get used to it. Why, sure, it gets right into every cell and kind of becomes part of you. There's a physiologic process, too, in most cases. But the physiologic process isn't addicting unless the psychological process is there too. If we take someone from this audience that is strong and happy and try to make them into an alcoholic or a heroin addict, we could do it. We could do it, but the way we do it is so destructive that you see it would happen. In other words, if I lock him up and if he won't take his heroin, I beat him and hit him. Well, eventually he's going to feel so weak and inadequate, he's going to say, what the hell, and the heroin will relieve the pain and misery. So the point is, could you convince him to take it just because it feels good and make it available? You could, to some extent, get an adequate person to take it, but he wouldn't become addicted to it. He would just use it for whatever pleasure it could bring, the same as a person uses alcohol, many people who aren't addicted. But if you took it away from him, he wouldn't miss it that much. And most cases wouldn't use it. He just wouldn't want the feeling if he feels okay without it, because a strong person enjoys the active pleasures of life. He's not that interested in the passive pleasures, only to a certain extent. It's when you're weak and you don't have the active pleasures, you don't have the fun of going out and doing something and getting congratulated, or the fun of finding love and worth, love in your life, that you begin to say, well, maybe I'll have the passive pleasure, which is a pretty good pleasure, especially if you don't have the other. In other words, if you feel lousy because nobody loves you, and then you find a drug and the drug gets rid of the pain and makes you feel good besides, that's a pretty damn good trade-off. And that's why people get addicted. And that's why these drugs are addicting. The only definition acceptable now for an addicting drug is you'd like to have it. That's the only definition. There's these other things built on physiologic things. None of them really work out. The book to read on addicting drugs, if you're dealing with drugs and you don't read this book, then you're making a big mistake. The book is only $4. It's called Licit and Illicit Drugs. It's published by Consumers Union, written by a man named Edward Brecher, B-R-E-C-H-E-R. And it's by so far the best book on drugs that all other books mean nothing alongside of it. It's honest, and it's true, and it tells you the story. It doesn't tell you how to deal with drug addicts, but at least gives you some understanding of what the heck is going on. Now, I've given you other things besides in this book, but that's the third choice, the choice to become addicted, a very common choice. And a choice which creates a lot of work. It's an interesting thing. It's interesting. Evidently, the government in its cutbacks is thinking about cutting back some of the anti-drug programs. And the anti-drug programs have a huge propaganda arm, so they pump stuff out to the newspaper. And so you see in the newspaper periodically, heroin on the upswing. I doubt if heroin's on the upswing. I doubt if it's on the downswing. It's always about the same, I would imagine. But if your money's running out, you pump out it's on the upswing. And if you got good, sufficient funds and you want people to keep giving you the funds, you pump out it's on the downswing, so they'll say you're doing a good job. So anyway, right now there must be hassling. And it's on the government's talking about legalizing marijuana, or at least not making criminal penalties. It's all part of the same thing. And so they immediately tell you heroin's on the upswing. Well, in this line of heroin, they tell you about all the trouble heroin does. It causes $10 billion worth of damage to the country a year. Interesting, $8 billion of the damage is law enforcement. No, $6 billion is law enforcement. And $6 billion is law enforcement and corruption. $6 billion. Because of heroin, if you see the French Connection or pictures like Serpico. And then about the other monies of the other $4 billion, about $4 billion is for treatment, for helping these people out. And there's $200 million of this $10 billion, $200 million is the direct harm to people caused by heroin. That is, they break down or something. So we're spending $9.8 billion to protect people from $200 million worth of disability. So you can see, this is the figures published in the paper, so you can see that it does, heroin certainly does cause a lot of action, and it makes for a lot of jobs. And so it would be dangerous to make it legal, because $9.8 billion would have to be not spent. And that would throw a lot of people out of work. And throw a lot of politicians out of money and crooked cops out of action. And it would just cause all kinds of upheavals. So I don't suspect it'll happen, because we're not going to suddenly take $9.8 billion out of the economy. Not in the way it's in the shape it's in now. So this kind of thing is going to continue. Now, alcohol is legal because we got to give the people something legal. I mean, if you don't, my God, they'll go right up the wall. We tried that one. That was a super disaster. Now, we got to provide legal gambling. If we don't, they're going to find illegal, so we tend to provide legal gambling and things like that. Different kinds of gambling, but it's all gambling. So those are the addictions. They're very important, and those are the negative addictions. Now, tomorrow morning, I like to talk about the concept of positive addiction, which gives you the other side of the picture and kind of fills the story out. Now, how do you handle all these problems? You handle these problems, I believe, using the concepts of reality therapy, or I believe using the concepts of any other therapy that will work. I happen to espouse reality therapy. If you believe in transactional analysis and that helps you, then use that. If you believe in psychoanalysis, use that. I've given up making comparisons between what I do and other therapies. I claim what I do is more effective, but I don't claim it very wholeheartedly. I mean, it's just a kind of a thing that if you don't claim it's more effective, and people say, what the hell are you talking about it for? But the point is, it's not up to me to make the decision it's more effective. It's up to the people who are using it. So if you're in the field and you're trying different methods and you're learning different techniques, try reality therapy. That's what I presume you're here to learn about. And if it works, then it's more effective for you. But I don't know if it's the holy grail of therapies or anything like that, but it's what has worked for me and what seems to be effective for me. That's why I espouse it. That's all, and I'm going to explain it to you. But I'd rather not answer questions, what's the difference between reality therapy and, or is it more effective, or is it work for this person better or that person? It works for anyone you can get it to work for. It has no particularly better effect or worse effect. It'll work on all the people in trouble if you can do it. The problem with reality therapy is, like any other therapy, it's easier to talk about than it is to do it. What I'm willing to do, and some other therapists who espouse various forms of therapy probably are willing to do this too, but some of them perhaps less so than I am, I'm willing to at least show you how it works, which I'll hope to do later this afternoon. But I'll answer all kinds of questions except these kind of questions. Will Dr. Glasser compare reality therapy and transactional analysis? You compare them. I mean, if you're interested, you compare them. I'll explain what reality therapy is. And I'm not a transactional analyst, and I couldn't do justice to explaining another form of therapy because it's not my thing. And so it would be unfair for me to even do that kind of a thing. Nevertheless, reality therapy is an attempt to help people who are weak to get stronger. And part of getting stronger is to make better choices. Not to choose to give up, not to choose to have a symptom, not to choose to be addicted. Now, these are choices that go down the line. The further they go down the line, the less painful they are, but the more you're wrapped up in the choice. In other words, it's more difficult to help an addict give up his addiction than to help a child who's just beginning to give up in school and maybe not learning to read. Because it's much easier to help a child to start going again than it is to deal with a person who's been addicted for a year or two and doesn't have any more pain. Now, the pain drives you toward being interested in doing better. So addictions, where there's no pain and even pleasure, makes it harder. But in any case, the way you'd approach them would be the same. Now, if we have people who will play an alcoholic or a drug-taking person of some kind or other, a gambler or someone like that, I can show you how you'd handle it specifically. But in general, you use the following steps. Another message here. Hold it. A phone call for Mr. David Dunaway. If the major problem in reality therapy has to do with your inability, your lack of strength to find love and worth, well, in almost all cases, you're lacking both. And it's very difficult to find a person that wouldn't benefit by having more love, care, and concern in his life. Very few people are just lacking in worth. They go together. So the reason the person has made his choices is he's weak. And one of the reasons he's weak is, I don't have enough people to care for me, because when people care for you and you care for them, that gives you strength and you make better choices. So if you're dealing with a person who's depressed, you're dealing with a person who's acting out, you're dealing with a person who's psychotic or a person who's got headaches or backaches or something like that, you can make the assumption that this person doesn't have the amount of friendship, love, care, concern in his life that he should have. To some degree, he's lacking in it. And that you yourself, you the therapist, you've got to provide him with some degree, some amount of what he's lacking. He may be lacking a whole bucket full, and you may only be able to provide him with a cupful out of the bucket. But nevertheless, that cupful is important because it's better than nothing, and it will at least get him to begin to believe, I've got somebody. Now I've got somebody. Before, I didn't have hardly anyone at all. So the first step of reality therapy is to make friends with the person, to establish rapport, to gain involvement. I just happen to like the use of the word friends the best. It's what you do. It's an honest term. It's not a jargon term. If you can make friends with a person, then you're starting in the correct way. Because your act of friendship will give him a little bit more strength than he has. And that's what he needs, is some strength. Just your care, your concern, your listening, your being there. You're not criticizing or downgrading him. Your interest in helping him, all these things. This show of friendship that you use, this helps him. Now, sometimes you show the friendship more than others. Sometimes, I mean, it's technical, and I'll have to show it, but you don't always show it in a very loving, kind way. Sometimes you show it in a very matter-of-fact way. But you always show it. Sometimes you have to show it by being strong and insisting that the person faces problems. But that's being a friend, too. So it's not all done in the standard friendship way, but like all friendship, it has a variety of facets, and you have to figure out the right way to be friends with this person that'll give him enough strength to start going. And with different people, those are different things. And now, how do you figure that out? I don't know. You just work at it. You practice it. You try it. The good thing about therapy is, any therapy, reality therapy and any other therapy, is that if you make a mistake, you don't lose the whole ballgame. You just made a mistake, try a different approach, that's all. You've lost a little time, perhaps. Maybe hardly that. It's not something critical, you know, like brain surgery or something, that if you make a mistake, I mean, it's not something you can easily correct. It's just you got to kind of do what the right thing. But therapy isn't that way. It's not that it's crude, but if you make a mistake, he'll correct it. That's all. Just tell the person, look, I was wrong. I should have never talked about that. It just didn't work out. And just say you're wrong and try something else. There's no such thing as saying, my God, I've done irrevocable harm to this client. I mean, you just haven't, that's all. You may not have helped him as much as you might, but you've really done him no harm. Anytime you try and help a person, you don't hurt him. It's just that sometimes you're more adequate than other times, that's all. And you work at that, finding out what it is. This is the whole experience. You're always learning. It's a good field. It's never dull, never boring if you keep thinking, well, what could I do to become more effective? So you figure that out, how you can become friendly with this person. If you become friendly with them, then the next thing you do is you want him as much as possible to face his problem. So let's go back to this depressed fox that came in, and he said, I'm depressed, and I tried these other things didn't work, and so I said, okay, I say, let me get to know you a little bit. Okay, that's fine. So he tells me about himself, we can make a little friends, and I say, all right, now I got an idea of who you are, and it's good talking to you, and then go on to step two. Step two is, what are you doing now? See, what are you doing now? Well, the fox would answer, well, he said, I'm not doing much of anything. You know, I'm just sitting around being depressed and watching all these foxes eat the grapes. Well, what do you want? Well, I'd like to get some grapes, too. Well, what are you doing? Well, I'm not doing anything. Well, how is not doing anything helping you? How is just sitting around doing nothing helping you? I mean, that's the question. That's step three. Step two, the fox has said, but I'm so depressed I can't do anything. I said, I understand that, but the point is you're still choosing to do nothing, right? Yeah, he said, well, how can I? I'm just so depressed. You know. Well, you know, is that helping you? Well, I guess it isn't. I mean, eventually he's got to come to the conclusion that doing nothing isn't helping him. So step two of reality therapy is, what are you doing now? Not how are you feeling now, not what have you done in the past, but what are you doing now? Now, you might tie it up with what have you done in the past. If you know more about his past endeavors, his past behavior, it would help you, then ask about that. But for the most part, you've got to concentrate on what he's doing now because that's what's got to be corrected. And this fox is doing nothing. He's lying around being depressed. So he says, well, I'm just lying around being depressed, I guess, yeah. And he said, well, is lying around helping you? No. So step three is what you're doing helping you? Make a value judgment yourself. How are you going to get those grapes by lying around? Your friends they're not throwing you grapes anymore. They got tired of you just sitting around there depressed. Yeah, he says, my friend's not doing too much. So you say, well, what could you do? And the fox says, well, I can tell you I'll never be able to jump and reach those grapes. I just won't be able to do it. He says, I've been to jumping school. I've done exercises. I was just built low to the ground. That's all there is to it. And so I say, okay, is there any other way you can get grapes? In other words, you know, he says, well, he said, I tried a gun for a while, but they locked me up for 3 years. That didn't work. It was great until they locked me up. Well, I said, gun isn't working too good. He said, well, what can you do? He said, well, he said, I, you know, just traveling low to the ground. He says, I can catch rabbits. And he said, some of those foxes like rabbits. He said, maybe I can catch some rabbits. Well, what'd you do? Well, maybe I can trade rabbits for grapes. That's been a possible trade. In other words, you work out an alternative plan. This fox is kind of traveling low, and rabbits travel low, and he can get rabbits. other foxes get grapes. And he gets himself a rabbit, and he goes up to the fox with a bunch of grapes, says, I'll trade you one rabbit for 18 bunches of grapes. Well, they determine the proper exchange rate. That's the history of the world, but eventually they get around to it. And so the fox gives a rabbit, and he gets the grapes back. That's a plan. Now he did something. He solved his problem. He doesn't like rabbits. He likes grapes. Other fox like rabbits, so they work it out. That's just what people do. In other words, whatever it is, many people you'll deal with will be inadequate to solve their problem one way, so you help them to figure out another way, that's all. You just keep working on ways they can solve their problem, but they got to do something. They can't just sit there and do nothing, because that isn't helping them. Or if they continue to do the wrong thing, like maybe yelling or crying or screaming or using a gun or getting sick or going crazy, that still isn't going to get them any grapes. So they got to figure out a better way. Now, your strength that you give them through your friendship, the strength they gain through your friendship, and the fact that you help them to face the fact that sitting around is not doing anything, all these things lead them to making a move. These are the grist of therapy. Step one, get involved. Step two, what are you doing? Step three, is it helping you? Step four, if it isn't, let's make a better plan. Let's work something out. Let's figure something out that's better. Now, if there is nothing at all that you can figure out, then you're stuck. But most of the time, you can figure something out that's better. Sometimes you'll be stuck, and then you got to say, well, you'll just have to suffer. There's just nothing else you can do. I mean, that's the way it is. When the person approached me at the break about dealing with dying people, I said, give dying people who are really dying, give them narcotics. Because narcotic drugs will remove the pain, the terrible pain and depression that goes with facing death. They'll take it away. And they'll also give them some pleasure. But I've had people say to me, when I've done this, as a doctor, I can prescribe narcotics. I've had people say to me, but you're going to make them into an addict. I'll say, that's what I'm trying to do. I hope I succeed. But that's wrong. In other words, some people believe that it's inherent in the Judeo-Christian philosophy that if you die, you ought to die miserable. But I think that the Lord wouldn't have provided morphine if he didn't have a use for it. Now, maybe it's used wrongly by a lot of people, but it's not used wrongly when you're dying. That's when you should have it. And the people that I dealt with that were dying, in every case, I didn't deal with many, but three or four, they died happy. They died very happy. And if I ever get an incurable disease like cancer or some serious heart disease that I'm checking out from, I certainly hope someone will give me morphine. And if I become addicted, that's great. My only worry would be that for some reason or other I couldn't become addicted. I'd be so damn straight that I couldn't even become addicted then. That would be a terrible situation. But that's what these drugs are for. When a man has a heart attack on the street and he believes he's dying, because when you have a heart attack, I've never had one, but people that have them tell me they're pretty frightening, and he believes he's dying, then the drug which will save his life is morphine. Because what kills you when you have a heart attack is not a big infarct in your heart where the blood loses. That doesn't kill you with a heart attack. That kills you a day later, or 24 hours or 48 hours later. What kills a man when he keels over on the golf course after a bad shot or something like that, what kills him is an arrhythmia. When you take his heart out of his body, it's absolutely perfect. And so what kills him is an arrhythmia, and the arrhythmia is produced by fear and tension and upset and everything else. And if you give him morphine, that fear suddenly goes away and he feels relaxed and he doesn't get the arrhythmia and he doesn't die. So there's lots of reasons to use narcotic drugs. But the reasons which many people use them are not, well, they're good reasons for them, but they're really harmful in the end, but in these cases, they're not. So the plan, when you got no plan at all, is either you got to settle for the pain and the misery, or you got to take something to relieve it. And that's, and then if there's something available and it's legal to take it, then you should take it, that's all. Now, what do you do? I was once dealing with a fellow that said, I'm a counselor in a prison. I'm dealing with people who are to a whole bunch of people who got a mandatory 25-year sentence for selling narcotics. I said, when are they going to get out? He says, in 25 years. It's a non-parolable 25-year sentence. I says, how long they got to go? He says, about 23 years. He says, what should I do then? I said, it's going to be tough. I said, you know, when you're in a prison and you're facing 23 years, you see everybody around you getting paroled after a year, two, three, four, five, six, seven, even murders are getting out in 11 years. And you're serving another 14 years, you're going to be upset. Now, can a therapy, can you work out a plan to be less upset? Well, maybe you can. You can take some college courses, but after 15, 20 years, they run out. I mean, what can you do when you're facing 25 years locked up in a pokey, away from your friends, away from love, away from worth, terrified when you walk around someone's going to stick a knife in you? Why, hell, that's miserable. I don't know what to do. If you got no hope, it's just going to be miserable, that's all. So if you're a counselor in a prison, you're working with long-term prisoners, do the best you can, but there ain't a hell of a lot you can do. So reality therapy has no answer to that one. Teach them, you know, meditation. Maybe that'll help them out or something like that. I mean, it's not a bad idea. It's what Papillon did. It worked pretty well for him. So, most of the time, though, you'll be in a situation where you can make some kind of a plan. You can, in some way, if you can get them going with a little strength, a little friendship, and they can see that what they're doing is inadequate, you can come up with some kind of a plan. You're rarely in a situation where you're facing death, where you're facing a 25-year sentence. These things happen, and people bring them up, but this isn't the common run-of-the-mill problem that you're faced with. This country may be tough, and it may be inadequate for people, and it may have very few pathways for certain racial groups and things like that. But in most cases, there's something that can be done better than what you're doing if you're suffering very, very badly. The fifth step of reality therapy is, if you work out a plan, for goodness sake, get the commitment from the fellow to do it. That gives him more strength. As what the equipment, commitment is another strength giver. If a fellow says, okay, I'm going to really go out and get a job. I'm going to look for a job. Because if I had work, I think I'd be better off. Well, work is hard to get, but he makes a commitment. And you say, okay, will you really look? I mean, will you tell me? Will you write it out? In other words, all you're really saying to him is you're helping him build his strength. You're saying, you're terribly interested he do this. So commitment is a further strength giver. And this is why in reality therapy, we ask people when they say they'll do something, within reason, we ask for a commitment that they'll do it. A friend of mine, a psychiatrist, who uses reality therapy, gets people to write it out. Keep a little book. He calls it their commitment book. And they write in the things they're going to do, and then when he sees them at the end of the week, they check off, have you done it or haven't you done it? But he doesn't ask them, because I've taught him.